Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Stephen St. John and Nate Bucati with the Drake Jason Justice filling in for Jay Gutierrez. We have Stan Weber in studio. And Stan, I thought there was a chance we'd be talking today about whether or not Jerome Tang was going to be lured back to Waco to be the head coach at Baylor, because when we were on the air yesterday, it seemed like there was at least a possibility that Scott Drew would take the Kentucky job. Scott Drew did not take the Kentucky job, and now it looks like it's going to be Mark Pope who they have focused on, and Mark Pope has been the head coach at BYU. And, of course, he was he played at Kentucky. And so let's first start there. Kentucky went after some big names. Kentucky did not get big names. They went after Dan Hurley. They apparently went after Scott Drew and were hot and heavy for him. If it ends up Mark Pope, maybe their fans won't be happy. But what do you think they have if that's the new head coach?
I think for Kentucky, we're talking about if we were rooting for Kentucky, right? Right now, let's make sure how we're asking and answering this question. That's okay, right? That's how you ask the question. I think Mark Pope's the best choice. I mean, Dan Hurley would be great because he's proven how well he coaches with UConn. He's hot. And I think he has a cockiness that Cal had that really fit with Kentucky. Just in-your-face cockiness, off-the-charts cockiness in college basketball is not really how coaches do it normally. They pay more respect to their opponents. But Dan Hurley could have went in there and been Mr. Cocky, so I'll give you that. But after that, I don't think you try to recreate what Cal brought. That swagger, we're going to get the best freshmen, we're going to win with one-and-dones, we're Kentucky, yes. I've been around him multiple times now. K-State's played him in the NCAA tournament, and it's just a different show when he goes up to the podium and speaks at these events. You have eight teams at an NCAA tournament site, and there's nothing like when Cal got up and spoke to the media. The Kentucky media, how he spoke, the confidence level. I mean, it's off the charts. But I think, actually, Mark Pope is the best choice. He coached in the Big 12 this year. You can't say, well, BYU doesn't play the same level of competition. They're out the West Coast. No, after this year, after going through the Big 12 and seeing what the grind is night after night and the variability that he has in his coaching style, they ran really three different systems offensively depending on who's in the game. They had two different centers that played completely different styles, and the team just switched to a new style immediately. He really accepts and is adapted to the analytics in the new game. Do you realize BYU is a three-point bombing team? But yet they'll use big guys when they have them and run offense around them. They'll play off the high post. They'll play low post. And guess what? He played and won a national championship at Kentucky. So that is the last part of it, right? He understands what Kentucky basketball is like, what this fandom is going to be, because I think that's the biggest challenge.
Big Blue Nation.
Dealing with Big Blue Nation. Because I've heard a number of people who've been around it. I've seen it a little bit, and it's a different animal.
Some coaches don't want to deal with it.
Right. It's an unrealistic, nasty thing. And there's a general lack of respect for basketball in the SEC from the whole nation, I think. That may be changing now that there's so much money going to the SEC. People are seeing better basketball. But don't you agree that generally people don't think of the SEC and basketball as a positive? That's why Kentucky has even more pressure, because everyone assumes they're going to win the league because no one else cares. Well, guess what? That's not the way it is. Who was in the Final Four this year? Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
There's some teams in the SEC in the talent level. K-State has been involved in the SEC Big 12 Challenge, and I go study these teams and go, oh, wait a second. You know, they may not have the reputation, and their fans may not really care if they win or lose, but when you look at the basketball talent and the coaching, it is coming up and making harder for Kentucky to dominate. So you go there, and Big Blue Nation, the Kentucky Wildcat fan, thinks it should be easy. Like, you're going to win the league. That's no doubt about it. Now let's just talk about, are we going to win a national championship? And it's not that easy. So I think Mark Pope, he gets that. He's played there. He'll have an appreciation for it. He's been a good coach at BYU. I actually think that's the best choice. Better than Scott Drew. Because you can be friends with Scott Drew, like it appears Mr. Barnhart is. Is it Mitch Barnhart, the AD?
They made friends during COVID.
He went to Shawnee Mission North, I believe, right here in Kansas City.
Wow.
So, local guy, these contacts, you know, it's a small world, right? But the fact that he thinks Scott Drew is a successful coach, I have no problem with that. But think about what Kentucky's like compared to what the situation is around Baylor.
Yeah.
Scott Drew has flourished and built an unbelievable program at Baylor, but I don't necessarily think his personality is ready to go all shucks and love everybody and say things are going to be fine. When Baylor loses, you know what he says? He doesn't overreact. Look at him in postgame. He's not all griping about the officials and saying this is unacceptable, blaming players. He just moves on and goes, we'll be fine. A very positive attitude. You think that's going to cut it in Big Blue Nation after they lose a game and they think the world just ended?
Mm-hmm.
If you lose a game to Louisville in December, who cares? You know, but oh, there. So anyway, I actually think Pope is a better choice for Kentucky than Scott Drew was. And it has nothing to do with the Jerome Tang take. It has nothing to do with that.
But I said on Monday, because Jake brought this up to me yesterday, I said they should just hire Mark Pope and be done with it. And I'd go through all this charade of having people publicly turn them down. And they went through it, and here they end up with
Mark Pope. He hasn't said yes, right? Correct?
It looks like it's going to happen.
Okay.
So, yeah,
it makes all the sense in the world to me.
It's like Matt Jones from Kentucky Sports Radio. And, boy, it's fun to read the mentions from Kentucky fans when he tweeted this last night. He said, this is around 10 o'clock last night, Mark Pope, and he's as tied into Kentucky as anyone. Mark Pope is very smart, maybe the smartest dude to ever play here for real. He has a great offense, and he loves this place. Plus, he was part of the greatest team in school history. Assuming this is finalized, I'm going to pull for him as hard as I can. He deserves that. And so you're right, all those things.
Why wouldn't that just be a giant positive
right,
to Kentucky fans?
An exciting brand of basketball, somebody that had a tie to what some people feel the greatest team of all time, and he's made his bones at Utah Valley and at BYU. This is what it reminds me of. And you guys, and especially Nate, can put more context to this than I can. But what was when Kansas hired Roy Williams?
Well, everybody's very disappointed.
But how many people before him?
Oh yeah, he
said
was like
no.
The third choice or fourth choice,
right?
Yeah, yep.
And sometimes it's just what happens. Sometimes the first, second, third choice isn't the best choice, and then the guy you end up with is what Roy Williams at the time was. Right?
People were like, who? This is what we got to settle for? The third guy on Dean Smith's bench?
Dean Smith's probably trying to get rid of him.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I believe in Pope, and I do think it's a, for my knowledge base, obviously, I had never studied BYU like I did this year. So my appreciation for him and the BYU program skyrocketed. But I do think if I'm an analyzing from an AD's point of view, the fact that he went to the Big 12 is completely different than what he experienced the year before. Because you said Utah Valley. Does that really stir your mind if you're a Kentucky AD saying, oh, you won at Utah Valley? Well, okay, I'm not going to really count that. Oh, we won at BYU. Well, sometimes teams like Gonzaga out in the West Coast are beating up on inferior competition. Doesn't mean they don't have a great team, a great program. I mean, Mark Few obviously proved it in the NCAA tournament again, making it to the Sweet 16. So I'm not trying to bash him, but there's some questions about the grind you've got to go through in these big conferences. He just went through it in the Big 12, and the Big 12 was loaded. Great coaches, great teams, and BYU is right in there, competing game after game. So the fact that he went to Kentucky makes such a big difference. He's been a head coach. I think he's the perfect candidate.
I'm with you, too. When the Scott Drew stuff came up, I said to Steven, I just don't think that doesn't seem like a fit to me.
Now, Mitch Barnhart can say, I got you, man. I'll cover you on this. I'll keep the fans off of you. You do it your way. And it's like,
yeah.
That's so, like, hey, thanks, buddy. You're the boss. But it's so naive.
Yeah, like at Baylor.
And he didn't say yes. So I'm not saying he's naive because he didn't take the bait and go to Kentucky.
Yeah. I think Scott Drew is a great coach. Scott Drew, like the way that it was, at least when I was traveling with the Big 12 and you'd talk to people around like, they do it their way. And there's not a lot of prying into how you're doing it or what you're doing. And And Drew always kept a pretty tight circle about that stuff. You know, like a lot of times teams, if you're going in to visit, if you're the visiting team and you're going to have shoot around, you might want to go check out the weight room facility and things like that. And Baylor was always kind of known for being like, yeah, no, we're not letting you in here because you're not one of us. And I don't know how tight of a circle you can keep at Kentucky where there's magnifying glasses all around you. And everybody wants a piece of the organization, like you said. And you go on a little bit of a losing streak, and every single person that writes a Wildcat blog has some sort of scoop on what's going on with your team. And I can see Scott Drew looking at it like, well, I can clearly win a national championship here and not have to deal with all that stuff that you have to deal with there. I'm pretty much left to do the things the way that I want to do them here. It just didn't seem to me like that would be that attractive if I'm Scott Drew. I don't know. That's the way I looked at it.
The reason why he might think about it is he may trust the AD. That's very important.
Sure.
He probably grew up his whole life knowing that Kentucky was a different level.
Right.
He may want a new challenge. He's done it for over 20 years at Baylor.
Fair enough.
And then he seems so good at this, of not bringing it up, but the passion for basketball at Baylor isn't really there.
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
It's the exact opposite of Kentucky.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the pressures.
Yeah.
But what about the positiveness?
It's a double-edged sword, right?
Biggest, baddest thing in maybe the country.
Yeah.
Because at Baylor, I haven't been to the new arena because we didn't do full round robin this year. So one of the things is K-State played Baylor only once and played them at home. I've not been to the new arena. But last year, a team that's fighting for national championships, you know, you go there, and if it's a Tuesday night game, oh, it might be two-thirds full. It's not that they dislike it. They don't care. It's just not oozing out of their pores, and they don't have a giant school. It's not like the University of Texas with 50 to 60,000 students right there. It doesn't take very many as a percentage of them to be interested to come over and watch the game, right? But Baylor, it's not that big a school.
Yeah.
So I just but he has a new arena, new basketball facility. Maybe there's more enthusiasm for the program. I'm glad he stayed. He's a great coach. It's his program. His statue is going to be out there when they talk about Baylor basketball.
Yeah.
And he's such a good guy, it seems like to me. And now knowing Jerome Tang, who's with him for 19 years, you talk about that close circle. I mean, Jerome Tang was right there with him for 19 years. I've got to know a little bit more about Scott Drew through Jerome Tang. It seems to me like you'd hate to see him get eaten up and over 5 years being miserable and everyone's so unhappy that he only made the Final Four once or twice,
right.
But didn't win a national championship with Kentucky. You should win every year.
Yeah.
If you were asked to put some money on who would win more games and be more successful over the next 5 years, if they make it that long, would you pick John Calipari at Arkansas or Pope at Kentucky?
Man, that's a fun question.
I'm going to say Pope.
Because, by the way, can't wait for those games.
Oh, yeah. Especially when it's Arkansas at Kentucky.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
You'd say Pope? The big thing is right now is there's a lot of thought about the NIL number. A lot of talk about that. And in basketball, I think it's even more relevant than football. Because in football, it really is, what's the number, 40 players that matter, 32, pick a number. It's really what all those guys do that takes you to winning. In basketball, you got to give it up to, hey, if you have LeBron James on your team, if you have Michael Jordan, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
One guy can make a difference, definitely two. So I respect the fact that the NIL money figure and getting players to come for the money is something that we got to take into account going forward. But I'm not a guy who believes in that generally in sports at all. I don't know what that number is right now. It's growing every day because the race is on. Remember when the facilities race was going, the arms race? Well, right now, I can't go a couple of days until I hear someone else say, well, you know, the pool of money available for the basketball needs to be blank million. I'm not even going to fill the number in because it just keeps changing. We need this many million. And I'm hearing a trend throughout all big-time sports, not just basketball, but football, that the kids really aren't factoring in much about the other issues. Like, hey, I like the coach. You're going to really develop me. I like this part of the country. This is my home, or it's warm, or Definitely don't talk about academics, okay? You know, I really want to be an engineer, and I love this engineering program. But it's just how much money are you going to pay me?
Yeah.
So that seems to be a theme that really is out there right now, that they don't even need to visit your campus. You want to come visit and see what it's like and get a feel for the area? No. How much are you paying me? That's what I hear the theme is. But still, guys, I am not going to say if Arkansas has more NIL money than Kentucky, that that is going to get them over the hump. It's still, you've got to coach these players. And you can pay the best players, and if they're looking for money, they probably aren't focused on the right thing. Look no further than the Chiefs, right? How much? $500 million is what Patrick Mahomes signed a contract for, right? Does he make, what? What's the guess? $35 million, $40 million a year on commercials?
He makes a lot.
He's got more increases since original contract. So don't get me wrong. Patrick Mahomes is maximizing the amount of income he's making. So there's nothing wrong with getting rich. Nothing wrong with it. But do you think that's his focus, his main focus about what he wants done as a Kansas City Chief?
No. The money's Yeah, the money's the byproduct.
He can maximize all that money, but that still isn't where he's the check mark. If you had to pick one or the other, not 51-49, one or the other. Is he more interested in winning or that money? I think Patrick Mahomes checks off winning. Well, and these players who come to your college, 18-year-olds, and say, oh, thanks for the money. If they're just focused in on the money and nothing else, I'm telling you, it doesn't work.
That's why I think what Dan Hurley, to go back to him, that's what to me is so amazing about what he pulled off. And you know, Mike DeCourcy kind of pushed back on me when I mentioned that to him. But I stand by it, and you've listened. Most people have seen it's a clip that's made its rounds on social media over and over again about Hurley talking about how much he focuses on the parents of the kids he's recruiting, because he's got kids that are NBA players, but a lot of them aren't the number. Like, he only had like one guy as a top 50 guy, and he said because the parents are the ones that can give the young kids the perspective of, yeah, get some money now, that's great, but the bigger thing is get yourself ready for when the NBA comes calling so that you can make your real money there. So go play for a coach that's going to make you a complete basketball player and the most draftable person. And what you think is just the shortcut to a lot of money right now and being the star on your team might not necessarily be it. You could be a player that doesn't average as many points per game and has to be a team player and everything, but you're actually going to elevate your draft stock if you do it. And the parents understand that, some of them. And that's what he focused on. But I think it's going to be harder and harder to find those kind of players in the climate. But here's the thing about the Kentucky-Arkansas thing. They're both going to get players, right? Whatever the NIL money is, you know that Arkansas's got the money to pay. Kentucky's going to have money. They're going to get players. Which coach is going to get the most out of those players? Hasn't that been kind of the knock on Cal? Was that when he won a bunch, and I don't know if it's fair or not, but when he won a bunch, he just had the better players, and he coached them up some, but his tactics aren't that great, his strategies aren't, they don't match up with the best coaches in college basketball. If Pope is better at putting together a style of play and developing players, you got to give him the edge, I would think, because they're both going to get players.
Yeah, I'm not big on bashing John Calipari and saying he can't coach. I mean, that's fine, but that's not my thing. Because hurting the cats is part of coaching.
Right.
And he's got a bunch of one-year.
Yeah.
There was a cycle there where he was getting the greatest players in the world and trying to make them a team, and that is not easy. And they were only there to get ready for the NBA and were focused on Kentucky basketball for what, 6 months?
And he got those players a lot better. I'm not trying to say he's not a good coach, but I'm saying when you compare him to the best coaches, and I'm not saying it's fair either, but the knock is when it comes to developing a style of play, strategy, in-game adjustments, things like that, he's gotten knocked by a lot of people for not being at the same level as some of these other coaches in college. I don't know if that's fair.
I guess my focus, I'm picking, in Stephen's question, I'm picking Kentucky and Pope because I think he's legitimate. That's not a bash to Cal.
Right.
But it does matter at this point that Kentucky basketball tradition is different than Arkansas. So let's say Arkansas doubles him up on NIL and gets the first pick of who wants money, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So their payroll is higher.
Yeah.
So that would give Arkansas a slight advantage. And then you say, how good a coach is Cal? I just think part of being around Kentucky basketball is the pressure the players feel every day of the expectations that you've got to play great. When you are around the history and you expect to win, those things matter. That's part of that team building. And I don't think you can build that at Arkansas. My point is, just because you give money You know, if Jerry Jones runs in and says, I'm the richest dude in the world. I am the Dallas Cowboys owner, and I love Arkansas. They're like, yeah, great, old man. Love it. Thank you. Thanks for the extra $1 million. But when you walk around Kentucky and you put that uniform on, when you walk in that court on Rupp Arena, I just think there's a higher expectation. Like, you better play better. And I trust Pope and that aura a little bit more than I do the money that Arkansas may have. They're quoting maybe the best NIL money in the country. The highest payroll in a non-salary cap sport.
Yeah.
You know, Jerry Jones and Tyson.
Right.
Those are pretty good names to start with. The Waltons might be interested. Who knows?
No, they're good. They'll get players, but it'll be interesting to see both
what
of those programs.
What did you pick, Steven? I didn't hear your choice. If Pope's a coach at Kentucky, is it a 5-year question you asked?
I'm gonna go with Cal at Arkansas.
Okay.
And trust me, I don't want Arkansas to be good, but
oh yeah, because you guys had a big what's the rivalry called?
The Battle Line rivalry.
Battle Line.
I feel like I think the disrespect to Cal is a little too heavy-handed, and I think he's going to go in there with a chip on his shoulder, and I think there'll be a certain freedom for him to get out of Big Blue Nation and to be able to go to
Arkansas.
And
actually coach and not deal with all that other crap.
That's exactly right. And so I think he's got another run in him.
I'm not down on him. Yeah. I'm going to bet on aura over money.
Right. We'll see. It should be fascinating to watch. We'll take a break back after this on WHB. Welcome back to the Border Patrol and Sports Radio 810 WHB. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Stephen St. John and Nate Bucati with the Drake Jason Justice filling in for Jake Gutierrez. And we have Stan Weber in the studio. I wanted to ask you a draft question. The draft is right around the corner.
2 weeks from today.
Wow. Close. So, I wanted to ask you about what's the correct way to say? I want to say his name right. The Kansas State tight end Ben Sennett. Okay, like he's running for Senate, right? I had a little bird tell me that there are several people over at One Arrowhead Drive that like him a lot. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that would be an interesting weapon in the Chiefs offense. And also, they hosted him for an official top 30 visit. And that means NFL teams are allowed a total of 30 in-person visits to facilities. And so he was one of them. And so let's say he ends up getting drafted by the Chiefs. Tell me what you like about him and what would excite you about the possibility of Ben Sennett ending up with the Kansas City Chiefs.
I think the number one thing that I would start with is that he is more of the modern pass-catching tight end. So that's a big positive, I believe. But then when you say that, you better think about the alternative, like will they be able to line up next to a tackle and block in the run game? Protect the quarterback if you had to have full protection? Will they be able to play with the physicality and block linebackers? And that's where Ben Sennett is able to check a box as well because he is big and strong. So he is smooth. You know, for a bigger guy, he's smooth and makes you feel very comfortable in the passing game. But he also has come up under the K-State system where it's about physicality, multiple tight ends. He also learns to play different role as a tight end. You're not always flexed out. Like some places in the country, your offense is, you're a tight end, but you're rarely going to line up there. You know, you're going to line up in a slot. You're going to play like a wide receiver all your college career, but you're big enough that I'm sure you're going to be able to block. At K-State, you say, no, you might not only line up as a tight end, you might have a wing off your hip who's also a tight end, or you might be the wing lined up. Well, how many times do you see the Chiefs line up that way, Stephen, with two tight ends?
Right.
So the spatial side of this, if it makes sense, like a guard lives in a box, and everyone says the guard has an easier job than a tackle because you don't have exposed edge, right? I mean, they make it sound like it's easy, but in a lot of ways it's super complicated because there's just no room where you get to do what you want. Everyone is bouncing into your own center and tackle, depending on how the physicality of the play starts, are actually bumping you off of what you're trying to get done. So as a tight end, if you're not ready to be a tight end with a slot tight end next to you on a running play and not always be on the edge and have to be on an inside, you got to be like a guard sometimes. Sometimes you got the edge to cover, you're going to be like a tackle. And other times you're going to be like a running back where you're lined up as a fullback, H-back, to lead a play, block a linebacker, go off the edge and pick up a safety or go in motion. And then you need to be a slot receiver type because they're going to put you out and flex you out. Does that make sense? There's like four different roles a tight end at the elite level that Andy Reid expects you've got to be able to do. And Ben Sennett can check off each of those boxes. Now, the fact that he's a kid from Iowa who walked on to K-State, that mentality, being through not being a star the whole time, and really he didn't turn it on until Will Howard became the quarterback in the second half of last year, was his coming out party, and he had a great senior year. So he's only been a big-time scholarship star type of player for a year and a half. Why is that important? Because I think he's going to have a humble desire to continue to grow and improve. He hasn't made it yet. And so I think he'll be excited to say, in the pros, I'm not just an up-and-coming player. I'm a legitimate tight end. Growing up in this area, in Iowa, or being at Kansas State in Manhattan, he knows what the Chiefs are all about. So having the respect and the knowledge of what Chiefs football is about is a big part of coming in here and saying, you know what you need to do? Shut up and watch Travis Kelce, okay? Ask Blake Bell questions and see how to play the tight end position. Noah Gray, those kind of things. So, yeah, I think he'd be a great fit for the Kansas City Chiefs.
He was at the facility on Monday for his visit. And if you look at what they already have right now in the tight end room, obviously Travis Kelce and Noah Gray, they went out and signed Irv Smith. And they want they keep four tight ends because of the tight end usage. And so that would be a perfect fit, right? His like you said, his skill set. And so I know that we all...
What do they say his measurables are? Do you have it there? Because he's a big dude.
He's listed at 6'4", 247. I was just looking that up to see how he compared to Noah Gray. He's an inch taller and about 10 pounds heavier than Noah Gray's listed.
Noah does a great job, man. He is a great route runner.
Mm-hmm.
Watson and Noah Gray are the two guys that you wouldn't expect to dominate and are always in the right position and always catching the ball smoothly from Patrick Mahomes. Mm-hmm. Right, those two guys? One is a wide receiver, one is a tight end. But again, Ben's bigger, and when you play K-State, there's a physicality about how they play. The running game is still a big deal. And so that really preps you for the work you're going to do because guess what? They aren't going to ask Ben Sennett to go out and run the routes that Travis Kelce runs. Maybe 4 years from now he would get to do that. But right now you're not that guy. You're probably the second tight end who needs to make a key chip on a block. Yeah. Like bust this defensive end's hip and shoulder before you go out because Travis doesn't need to waste his time doing that, right? So, you got to play with physicality. I love what Noah Gray does. Blake Bell's a very underrated pro because I happen to know his family and everything else, so I'm a little biased here. But just think what he's done. We talk about Travis Kelce being an ex-quarterback and how smart he is and how he understands defenses. How about a guy who played quarterback at a big-time level at Oklahoma, the Belldozer, and now as a tight end in the NFL, he's played his role perfectly. He understands football like a quarterback. He understands being a pro and being understated and letting the game come to him. And how about the physicality? Because I'm telling you, if you grew up as a quarterback, I don't know how they transferred and play the physical game at tight end. And Blake Bell's done it.
And different people have him listed as a tight end or H-back or fullback, but I like to look at the relative athletic score that they put out.
He killed it at the draft camp.
Athletic testing on a scale of 0 to 10. He elite vertical, elite broad jump for tight ends. Elite shuttle, elite three cone, elite 40-yard dash, elite 10-yard split. And so he ended up as a tight end prospect in the 2024 class. He scored an unofficial 9.75. RAS score, which is relative athletic score, out of a possible 10, that ranked 29 out of 1,116 tight ends from 1987 to 2024. So he tested through the roof. Unbelievable.
Because I count what they do on the field.
Right.
99% and 1% all that stuff in Indianapolis. But the fact that he just was off the charts confirms that there's more there.
I'm telling you,
he's only been a big-time factor in college football for a year and a half. That's it. He was a walk-on working his way up at K-State, like many good players. And all of a sudden, when Will Howard came out, he started throwing the ball to Ben Sinnott in coverage.
The GMs will salivate at that.
So,
and so you add that.
He's got a lot of improvement because his game time snaps are probably on the fewest side of all of the prospects coming out. He probably played less snaps as a starting tight end. So his upside is still there for growth.
He might be a chief. We'll be back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Stan, who are you rooting for in the Masters?
I think I like Scottie Scheffler. These guys are so likable. It's hard to root against almost any of them because once you hear their story, you're like, I like that guy too. And DeChambeau played great yesterday. And when he got all pumped up, remember he said he's going to reinvent the game and became a bodybuilder and just smashed the ball down the course and tried to overwhelm the course. Was that 3 years ago? And I was like, I'm not into that. But he's totally changed his tune now. And he's on the LIV Golf Tour, so he's a little underrated. So I like seeing how he's playing because he's gotten better at the short game and the subtleties of the putting. But I love the Masters. It just dominates this weekend for me. Wish I could watch every shot. It helps, I think, in golf to know what the course is like. Because if a U.S. Open, a lot of times you're going, okay, or PGA especially, because they go around to public courses, you have no idea what the course is like. You can't remember, is it on 15 you're supposed to get a birdie, or is it 17 the hard hole? But with the Masters, you know the lay of the land. You know what's coming no matter who the golfers are. You know a lot about the holes, and I think that makes a big difference. Not only is it more beautiful and less commercials and all that, but I like Scottie Scheffler, a humble superstar.
He's off to a good start, right?
Oh, yeah. He's in second right now behind DeChambeau. We're watching Tiger Woods right now.
He was one under Tiger so far.
I have not kept track of how Tiger's done this morning. He had a few holes left, but he is playing excellent, which meant like one under golf.
Let's see. Here's one update. There are already signs that the short turnaround from Thursday evening is affecting Tiger after ripping a 314-yard drive down the 14th fairway and into the rising sun. He looked uncomfortable standing over his approach shot from 124. He hit it fat, and his ball landed 22 yards on the hole. After the shot, he stretched his neck and grimaced. Woods chipped his third shot 22 feet past the hole. He two-putted from there for a bogey, dropping to even par after 14 holes. And then had a missed opportunity to get back to a red number on the par 5 15th hole.
You got a birdie the 15th.
See.
But he didn't. He had a par on the 15th.
Says chip shot was long, settling for about 17 yards above the hole. He showed great touch around the greens again, chipped to 4 feet, remaining at even par with 3 holes left in the opening round.
And then he goes to the Vern Lundquist hole.
This is Vern's last one, isn't it?
Yeah. 40th Masters, and the last one calling the 16th.
He's a goat. He's one of my favorite broadcasters of all time.
He's great.
Yes. And I read about his start, and it's just kind of amazing. But he was the voice of the Dallas Cowboys when I was a younger person.
I think about big college football games, I think about Vern Lundquist.
Yeah, he was asked what his greatest event was, and his answer was, I think, 1986, when Nicklaus made the putt on 16 and the comeback and won his last Masters when he was in his 40s. That was number one. But Tiger Woods tied it on 16 when the Nike ball rolled and stopped and then fell in on 16 that he called. But you know what his number one moment was? Those are tied for second.
What's number one?
The number one all-time event that he's ever called was Alabama-Auburn football when the missed field goal by Alabama turned into a return by Auburn. The kick six game. He said and it wasn't just that play.
Everything about it.
He's like, he said, Amari Cooper had a 99-yard touchdown reception in the game, and no one even talks about it. Stuff like that was going on.
How could you beat that atmosphere, too?
Auburn.
The context around
it. And then all the things, like Nick Saban so mad that he wanted time to kick that field goal. Remember?
Right.
The clock originally ran out. He's over there berating the officials. No, there's 1 second left. We got a time to kick a field goal to win this game. And then the field goal comes up short, 9 yards deep in the end zone, forget the player who caught it, went down the left sideline. And
who's your favorite broadcaster of all time?
Al Michaels, probably.
Yeah. I think that might be mine.
So
Al Michaels and Jim Lampley.
Have you
Dick
guys...
Enberg, it would be second. Because being in broadcasting, you know, we talk about our other parts of broadcasting. Even doing this show is different than when you were doing UMKC games,
sure.
Right? Or when you're doing games now for Fox. The different environments, what amazes me is Dick Enberg's ability to go from one sport and different personalities and make the analyst sound like they're brilliant. If Jimmy Connors comes off the court, or McEnroe, or Everett, or Merlin Olsen, it didn't matter who his partner was, he immediately made them sound awesome. And I think Jim Nance has done that for Tony Romo as well. But I think Dick Enberg did that better than anybody, made his analysts great or sound better than they should.
That's Dan Weber. We'll be back after this on WHB.